This week we will be studying Joshua 22, in which the eastern tribes return home, and a misunderstanding nearly leads to a deadly conflict when the eastern tribes build a mysterious altar. Herein, we will learn about the importance of clear communication in maintaining healthy relationships, about the dangers of leaping to conclusions and rushing to judgment, and about the seriousness of sin and its grave consequences. Your passage, then, is Joshua 22, and if you haven't read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. It has been over a month since we've studied a narrative chapter in Joshua. We've been talking about the maps in the intervening time period, and we reserve those messages for members due to their dense technicalities. So, since we've been out of the narratives for a while, let's have a brief recap. The book of Joshua is the story of the conquest of the Promised Land. The land had been promised to the people of Israel, and Moses led them to the land. But on the way, Israel conquered a large area east of the Jordan River, from which they launched their invasion. 2.5 of Israel's 13 tribes asked Moses if they could settle in that land east of the Jordan, rather than taking land in the Promised Land of Canaan, west of the Jordan. We first studied that in a message, Tribes East of the Jordan, published June 8, 2019, but have mentioned it many times since. Moses permitted this, but only on the condition that the tribes would promise to lead Israel into battle in Canaan and remain in Canaan fighting until the land had been sufficiently taken. And of course, our previous study in Joshua describes how the land was taken. And now that we're through that descriptor, today's passage tells us how Joshua sent the tribes home, and what happened as they split. In the opening of today's passage, in verses 1 through 9, Joshua sent the 2.5 tribes back home. In verse 1, he summoned them, and in verses 2 through 3, he commended them for their work. They had indeed been faithful to take the promised land and had kept God's charge through Moses by not forsaking their brothers. As a result, we read in verse 4, Israel had finished the job. The work was done. The 2.5 tribes had no more duty to stay in Canaan, west of the Jordan. They could return home to the east. But in verse 5, Joshua gave them a charge. Obey the law of Moses. The law was not a means to an end of conquering the land. The law was to be a way of life for these people for generations to come. And so, even though the eastern tribes would be separated by a river, a much bigger barrier in those days than today, they would still need to keep the law. They were to cling to the law, and in so doing, to serve God with all their heart and soul. Before the tribes left, Joshua gave a special blessing to the tribe of East Manasseh. The passage reminds us that Manasseh had split in two, with half on one side of the Jordan and the other half on the other side. The blessing, in verse 8, was material in nature. Joshua told them to go home with much wealth, wealth in livestock, precious metals, and clothes, which were much more expensive at the time. And in addition to all that wealth, he said that they should divide the spoils of war, taking even more wealth from their enemies, and should divide it with their brothers. So basically, he told them, may you be very rich. And with that, the tribes went on their way back to the Transjordan. And that is the introduction of our story. In our second act, verses 10 through 12, we have the introduction of a conflict. On the way home, before they crossed the Jordan River, the eastern tribes stopped and built an altar. And it was a large altar, one which surely could be seen from a distance. Why did they build it? Well, the passage doesn't resolve that tension. Now, we haven't talked much about altars in the book of Joshua, but altars were used for the ritual sacrifice of animals, and that was an important part of Israel's worship of Jehovah. Go back to the Torah for that. But in worshiping Jehovah, animals were only to be sacrificed at the tabernacle, or at the very least, under the direction of the Levitical priests. So this altar looks like a big problem. The people of Israel presume that this altar was built in an attempt by the eastern tribes to break from the service of God at the tabernacle. And if that was the case, then these tribes could be turning to cultic worship of the false gods of the peoples of Canaan. And that would be very bad news, because Israel's entire purpose in this book was to kill the people of Canaan for their pagan worship. And so on seeing this altar, the people of Israel west of the Jordan prepared themselves for war against the eastern tribes. But before launching an attack, the western tribes sent a delegation to discuss the matter with the eastern tribes, as described in verses 13 through 20. The delegation was led by Phinehas, the high priest, representing the tribe of Levi, and 10 elders of Israel, one for each of the western tribes, those being Judah, Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun, Ephraim, West Manasseh, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, and Asher. I want to stop and note here briefly that the passage says explicitly that these elders were the head of a family. I have noted before that Israel's structure was based on familial lines and not geographical lines. The nation was those born of Jacob, called Israel. His sons became the heads of the tribes, and their sons became the heads of clans, and within those clans were families. Each of these men was an elder head of a family. So, because it is implicit in the passage, I want to note how important it is for leaders to first lead their own families well. There is a duty in being a father, and that duty is to lead. Your families need training. They need provision. They need conflict resolution. And a man takes on such duties when he becomes a father. And good fathers should become leaders. Do not neglect this. In verses 16, 18, and 19, we read West Israel's accusation against East Israel. You've built an altar in rebellion to Jehovah, and we know that you've done it in rebellion because you intend to make sacrifices on this altar instead of on Jehovah's altar. And they are sure to point out why this matters. The consequence of persisting in sin against God harms everyone in the community. So West Israel couldn't allow East Israel to sin without harming West Israel, even if West Israel wasn't involved in the sin. To demonstrate this, they cite examples of the history of sin in their ranks. In verse 17, they discuss Israel's sin at Peor. You can read more about that in Numbers 25. In Moses' generation, the people of Israel worshipped Baal at Peor in the wilderness and fornicated with Midianite women. My presumption is that when they say that the congregation had not yet been cleansed of this sin, they mean that there still existed among the Israelites some spread of disease which was picked up from the Midianite women. Such diseases made people unclean for tabernacle worship. So that would be a perfect example of how sin hurts everyone. Everyone wasn't involved in the worship of Baal at Peor, but the uncleanliness of Baal worship persisted even into the next generation. Now, the passage doesn't explicitly speak to disease, so I am speculating there. But regardless, uncleanliness persisted in some form. And in verse 20, they cite the case of Achan. You remember Achan, no doubt. Achan appeared in Joshua 7, and we discussed him on March 22nd of 2020 in a message titled Battle of Ai, Part 1, Achan's Sin and Joshua's Prayer. Achan had stolen the devoted things from Jericho, and as a result, all Israel lost the battle at Ai. So sin doesn't hurt just the sinner. It hurts everyone who gets close to it. And these elders explicitly state this outcome in their complaint, saying, if you too rebel against Jehovah today, then tomorrow he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. And that is something which they cannot permit. In verse 19, they offer their solution. Their solution presumes a reason that the eastern tribes would have leapt into building an altar. Perhaps the eastern tribes believed that an altar was necessary because there was something unclean about their land east of the Jordan. And seeing that that might be the case, West Israel offered that, rather than turning from the true worship of the tabernacle, the eastern tribes ought to come and share in the inheritance west of the Jordan. But the response from the eastern tribes is not that the land is unclean, or that the eastern tribes are turning to worship false gods, or that they are trying to break with the tabernacle at all. As it turns out, this is all a big misunderstanding. Much to the contrary of the West's theories, the Eastern tribes were trying to ensure that they could remain with the tabernacle. In verses 21 through 23, they say that God knows their intent, and they are so confident of their intentions that they make a self-maledictory oath with God as their witness. They say that if their intent was to make false sacrifices, then West Israel could go ahead and kill them. The actual purpose of the large altar is revealed in verses 24 through 29. The altar was simply a memorial sculpture to remind West Jordan of East Jordan's right to serve Jehovah. The eastern tribes would be separated from the tabernacle by distance and by a river which was difficult to cross. If a division like that persisted for a long time with limited communication between the sides, cultures would begin to diverge. The eastern tribes feared that someday that cultural divergence would get the better of them, and the western tribes would see a distinction between the two of them, and would disallow the eastern tribes from coming to serve Jehovah. The eastern tribes wanted to ensure that this would never happen, and so they built the altar as a monument to remind the western tribes that the tribes in the east also had a right to come to the tabernacle and serve. So at first, it looked like the eastern tribes were turning away from the tabernacle. It turned out to be exactly the opposite. They were clinging to it. In verses 30 through 31, we read that the elders accepted the response from the eastern tribes. They were glad to hear it, no doubt, and they expressed their gladness that Jehovah's anger would be turned away from them, and that instead, they could be confident that he would be among them. And so the elders went home, bringing the news of the conference back to the people of the western tribes. They too accepted the explanation and the altar, and so war was averted. Wrapping up the passage, the eastern tribes called the altar witness, because its purpose was to serve as a witness. What lessons can we learn here? First, don't jump to conclusions, particularly about another person's intent. The western tribes leapt to a conclusion about the tribes of the east, that they were abandoning pure worship, but this was not correct. When they sent a delegation to have clear communication about the supposed problem, the conflict was quickly resolved, and so we too might see the actions of others, actions which are not necessarily wrong in themselves, and rush to judgment about a person's motivations. This can create undue friction. Now, actions themselves can be compared against the scriptures and judged whether they are right or wrong. If you catch someone in the act of taking something that doesn't belong to him, for example, it's pretty safe to leap to the conclusion that that person has done an immoral thing. He's stealing. But even then, you don't know his motivations. Perhaps he is stealing simply for the thrill. Perhaps he is stealing to spite someone. Perhaps he is desperate to feed his family. Now, none of those things would justify stealing, but the motivation is hidden, nonetheless. And so, in more benign actions, which aren't actually wrong, we don't know the motivations of other people until we ask and get an honest answer. We should be very careful not to judge motivations. Suppose someone gives you a sour face one morning. You might take it that person doesn't like you, and it might harm your relationship. Well, maybe that person is feeling down that day because his dog died. If you didn't ask, you wouldn't know. But the fact that a person is sad because of some personal tragedy is no reason for there to be any harm to your relationship with that person. However, such things happen when we judge motivations. So don't leap to judgments about intent. In everything, do your best to give people the benefit of the doubt. Presume the best in each person until that person gives you some compelling evidence to the contrary. When you judge, use right judgment. The laws of God, not the dictates of polite culture, are the standard of right and wrong, and we should apply those laws to the actions of others rather than concerning ourselves with trivial matters and with a person's intent. Second, good communication is key to maintaining healthy relationships. This was the origin of today's conflict. The eastern tribes were concerned that over time there would be a breakdown in communication over a distance, and then a breakdown in the relationship, until they were no longer welcome among God's people. They sought to remedy this by communicating to the western tribes their share in the tabernacle, but the message of their memorial structure was unclear. The resolution to that problem was good communication, and Israel's actions in resolving the problem was a great example for us today. Everyone involved sat down, not to fight about who was right and who was wrong, but to resolve the perceived problem. The western tribes were honest and clear about what the problem was, and were convincing in describing the consequences of the problem. They offered evidence, and they also offered solutions to resolve the problem. And the eastern tribes were honest and clear in communicating their intentions. In many cases, that kind of open dialogue can go a long way toward resolving the problem. In this case, the parties determined that there really wasn't a problem at all. It was just a misunderstanding. And so we also should seek to have good communication to improve the health of our relationships. We also note the value of keeping memorials, because memorials, set in stone, can communicate to future generations what we will no longer be able to communicate when we are gone. And furthermore, the memorials set by those before us can communicate to us the things that we may have forgotten. Third, in any conflict, you should try to find a peaceful and harmonious resolution before you resort to war or total relational breakdown. When the western tribes saw the altar, they readied their armies. Thankfully, cool heads prevailed, and the parties were able to resolve the matter amicably. And Israel was clearly willing to offer solutions, not just to make complaints. In fact, they showed an eagerness to keep the relationship intact, even to the extent that they were willing to give up a portion of their land to keep a good relationship with their brothers. Now, that kind of self-sacrifice may not always be in order, but the Western tribes were certainly willing to do what was necessary to make peace, rather than to have war. War should be a last result in a desperate situation. Let us seek, then, to have peace with everyone, inasmuch as it depends on us. Fourth, we should be clearly conscious of the seriousness with which Israel considered sin. When they saw sin, they took action, and they were prepared to take the most serious actions possible, even going to war to stop sin. And if it would resolve the problem, they were prepared to give up their lands to stop sin. Both are big steps that they're willing to take to resolve the problem, and they're only willing to resort to such drastic measures because they recognize the severity of the problem. They understood clearly that sin leads to death, and it doesn't just lead to the death of the sinner, but ultimately to the entire community. Sin is no game, so whatever sin you have in your life, put it to death. Whatever sin you have in your community, root it out. If you ignore it and allow it to fester, you do so to your own harm. So then, in conclusion, in today's passage, the Eastern tribes went home, but in going, they built an altar. They built it as a memorial, to ensure that they would remain in good standing with the tabernacle. But the gesture was misunderstood, and the Eastern tribes believed it represented a break between the Eastern tribes and the tabernacle. This miscommunication almost resulted in a war, but with a little communication, the intent was made clear and peace was restored. And this is a good example for us in our dealings, be they interpersonal or international. We see that peace is preferable to war, and that war should only be a last resort. We see that good communication is the key to healthy relationships, that it is important to remember our history, and that we must be careful that we judge only the overt actions and not the secret intentions of the heart. We also see here the seriousness of sin, which cannot be tolerated. Sin in one person harms everyone, and so sin cannot be allowed. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.